I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 41 of Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast. This episode is entitled Storming America, Intelligence Failure is Now and Forever. So, welcome back, and I appreciate the correspondence that I have received from listeners and readers of my dispatches on Substack. I urge you to follow me on Substack if you get the opportunity. Shout out to my paid subscribers for your solicitude and support of these efforts. Some housekeeping notes. I've changed the feed at the Substack for my RSS and stuff and opened up that black box and played around a little. So you may find that some of the episodes are either missing in the feed, like three of them that I've discovered, but I hope to resolve that soon. If you wish to correspond with me, you can email me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. And I would also urge you, if you haven't visited my Substack, or if you have, to use the opportunity to leave comments and start and continue conversations on there on all the episodes that I have archived there from 1 through 40, this being 41. Personally, while I am not a large consumer of mainstream and corporate and access media, I find that one thing that I will do all the time is that if a news organization eliminates public comments and comment sections and such, I will not go there for a variety of reasons, to include that, well, there's a reason why they call it programming. While I am on Twitter occasionally, at W. Buebert is my handle there. If you care to join me or follow me, please do so. I have tried to stay away from that time vampire as I can because I find that on occasion I'll get on the X or Gab to a lesser extent and time just gets away from you. So I've tried to discipline myself and not be on there as much. I find it's a good commenting feature to have X or Gab and such so that one can maybe explicate or throw your short list ideas or your short form ideas on the wall and see where it goes, what it takes, people's thoughts on it. What I refer to as brainstorms are those mighty intellectual winds that guide us to do great things or not so great things. Brain Zephyrs is on the opposite side of the spectrum, where it's something that you come across or some thought that you've come across in your own reading or meanderings or conversations with other smart people, and you want to see where that goes, or maybe in a short form, put it down and see what comes of it. So I use my notes feature on my Substack to do that very thing, to post those kind of ideas. And I want to just post a couple notes here before we get into the meat of this podcast today. And that's, I need my audience to understand the distinction between regional and global hegemons. Now, a hegemon, of course, is a country or region that through alliance seeks to either cement its influence and shaping of the conditions within the constraints of its own boundaries, or to extend that beyond its own boundaries, most likely contiguous, sometimes not so contiguous. For instance, you will find that China has, for the most part, always been a regional hegemon militarily and a global hegemon economically, what they would refer to as soft power. You'll find that Russia has always been, for the most part, a global hegemonic aspirant, but they pretty much resign themselves, I think, to being regional hegemons with influence over the area that is contiguous to them, and as with China, sometimes not so contiguous to them, as we've seen with Chinese and Russian influence operations in Africa or South America over the past 120 years. All empires must cement regional hegemony before they can establish and instantiate global hegemony. Most empires fail and turn to dust over time. And one of the elements that you discover that causes this very thing to happen, to include the internal contradictions of what happens when empires go abroad, whether it's the British Empire, the Roman Empire, or the Byzantines, or the American Empire or such, they start to expand themselves beyond which their checks can draw on the accounts that they actually have, and find they start putting their fingers in dikes that are created through what I love to call chaos avalanches throughout the far reaches of these empires. Afghanistan is a great example of this, which could inevitably, and I think possibly one can come up with a law for this when it comes to imperial overreach and overstress and overstretching, that they dissolve themselves as a result of the ambition and the aspiration to become global hegemons. This is where the United States is today. Now, China, as a military global hegemon, I don't see it. I don't see that ambition beyond their region or super regional capabilities, because when you look at Chinese history, for instance, rarely are they able to externally project successful military power beyond their contiguous borders, and the history proves that out. The same thing applies to the Russians, who have suffered an invasion from Europeans in both 1812 and in 1941 with Operation Barbarossa under Hitler in World War II. So China and Russia can also be referred to, in a certain extent, psychologically, as paranoid powers. Those powers that think that the world may be out to get them. Now, for the Russians, as I just observed, there were the military stratagems employed against them. Now, China has suffered both military and political stratagems that have been levied against them since the end of the 18th century, if you examine the history, and we'll be doing that here on occasion in future episodes. So I just wanted to suss that out because it's going to have a lot to do, well, on reflection, it has a lot to do with everything I've talked about in the last 40 episodes when it comes to American overextension of its empire. And of course, in the succeeding episodes to this one, what that's going to have to do with the eventual turning to dust of the American empire, which is an historical inevitability, whether we like that or not. The fatal flaw for global hegemons, which seek to dominate the entire planet, is that sometime, somewhere, leaks will appear, foundations will start to sunder, shields will shatter, spears will split in half, and various things won't work out quite the way that global hegemon thought that they would. You have heard me say in the past that America hasn't won a war, for a variety of reasons, since 1945. And if we simply look at the last quarter century, and we look at Afghanistan, we look at Iraq, we look at Syria, we look at Libya, we look at the Horn of Africa, we look at what's currently happening in the last week in Chad and Niger in Africa, where not only do we potentially have troops stranded there who have not been repatriated back to CONUS or bases in Europe, but we have a lot of these former colonial powers that assumed their own independence and played the great game throughout the last probably 75 years since the end of World War II, vying to find who they would ally themselves with, like India's flirtation with Russia, African nations' flirtations with Russia, with China, with the United States, seeing who could support their various kleptocracies across the Dark Continent. And what you discover is that everything is starting to unwind once again. And if you thought the ride was wild militarily for the United States in the last 50 years, wait for the next 50, because strap yourselves in. It's going to be a rocky road, and it's going to be very, very interesting. So in episode 37, I did a podcast episode on Storming America, Another War Will Come Home. And I wanted to thank everybody for reaching out to me. I got a tremendous response and feedback from my listeners where they said, Bill, let's suss this out. Let's try to see how we can find out and tease out more of the fundamentals and potential forecasts that one can divine from this and all of those kind of things. So I have decided to embark on a multi-part series on Storming America. This is the first of those additional parts. It's called Storming America, Intelligence Failure is Now and Forever, because I thought to myself, if we're going to go back to the whiteboard or the drawing board or the chalkboard, for those of you old enough to remember all of those things, and try to assess what are the fundamentals of war making and preparing for war making and preparing war plans and anticipating conflict, and what are things going to look like in the future? Can we take a view to history or to the recent past and try to use that as a baseline from which we can forecast and predict what's going to happen? Now, by definition, I think the evidentiary basis for prediction is a little bit more concrete and formidable than it is for forecasting. So in that case, what we're going to do here is a lot of forecasting, not much prediction, because the quantitative and qualitative necessary components for prediction, not only is that difficult for this, not only is it something that I don't think is sufficient for the casual audience for this podcast, but I also think that forecasting, while it doesn't have as much evidentiary heft, I think it can still get us going in the direction of, what does the future have in store for us? For instance, one thing that I postulated the other day, again, a brain zephyr that I posted to my notes at Substack, was that I think, for instance, a forecast, not a prediction, Elon Musk has 5 to 10 years to get to the red planet. Now I'm calling the ball at 2030 as the point of no return. Now, why is that? It's because I think the combination of digital and stupidation, the STEM reproducibility fraud phenomenon, and the chaos avalanches of the competency crisis that are rippling through everything here in the West will make that success more and more unlikely year by year. While I think the digital screen has been a boon, it's also a curse in that it's rewiring cogitation and thinking in a severely negative fashion. We're just past the cusp of digital natives as parents having their own children and raising them in a fashion they are acquainted with, which will also have downstream effects in this, I'm declaring it, winter of our civilization. We're also entering the end of that 70 years of relative peace in the West, not the rest of the world, since the end of World War II, that has been the unusual interregnum of not violence, unlike the perennial violence that characterized the human experience before. Thank you, Kurt Schlichter, for coming up with that nugget. Now, just so you know, that violence is screaming and pounding at all the gates of Western civilization, and it will be breached or sundered, ladies and gentlemen. I have sad news for you, but that is certainly the case. Again, it's probably an impetus behind me teasing out and expanding on my original podcast episode in 37, Storming America, The War Comes Home, and why we're going to start looking at that in detail starting with this particular podcast episode, where we will examine intelligence failure. If I had any pending invitations to the intellectual salons of Washington, D.C. or other Western capitals, and the cocktail parties at the ambassadorial and consular functions in D.C. and its environs in the rest of the world, and maybe intelligence community as a phraseology in and of itself, and the dozen plus intelligence organizations that comprise that under the director of national intelligence. After this episode, I think that all those invitations that may have been pending, which I really don't think were, are going to be withdrawn immediately, and I will become PNG in the entire IC. But there it is. Such is the burden of those who interpret the truth and tell it like they see it. Thank you, Mike Rowe. While there is bad actors, bad behavior, and just horrific things that have come out of the United States intelligence community in the last century, and especially accelerating past the end of World War II with the establishment of the Central Intelligence Agency, While I'm not going to burden you with a very sophisticated and detailed history of those, I would urge you, if you are interested in knowing why the CIA should be disbanded and the earth salted where Langley's facilities, and maybe its facilities planet-wide, are and have been, I urge you to read two books, Ghosts of Langley by John Prado and Weinstein's book, Legacy of Ashes. So those two give you a really in-depth overview of what's happened since 1947 and 1948 with the establishment of the CIA, which came out of the Office of Strategic Services in World War II under Wild Bill. They were at a crossroads in 47, 48, 49, where they had the opportunity to be an intelligence analysis component of the federal government and the West to forecast and predict, by the way, and make very deep and wide analysis of events around the world to ensure a neutral or beneficial national security environment to the United States proper and its allies. There was a fork in the road. Do they confine themselves to analysis or through clandestine and covert operations planet-wide in the employment of paramilitary functionalities, messing around with franchise and voting operations through color revolutions, the coups of various flavors that one could conduct planet-wide, and to do all those kind of sexy espionage functions that Jean Le Carré and other authors have sussed out in the unclassified realm to show you what that kind of shadowy and dark world was about. So that bifurcation was between analytical functions and maybe taking those analytical functions and using the knowledge garnered from that to try to shape and influence the conditions in different countries or regions to, again, and I'm being very charitable with this, be neutral or beneficial to the national security needs of the United States and its allies. Now, when we look at everything that has happened, and Weiner and Prado go into excruciating detail on what happened with a lot of these covert action activities, for instance, in the 1950s, where hundreds, if not thousands, will we ever know, of Eastern European or former Soviet bloc personnel were parachuted behind enemy lines, in this case the Warsaw Pact and the USSR, inevitably into the waiting arms of the NKVD or KGB personnel who were waiting on the ground for them at the landing zone to scoop them up and either dispose of them there, take them back for extensive interviews, or to turn them into double agents or whatever the case may be. Because if the Russians, and a little lesser so the Chinese, have singular espionage capabilities, when it came to foreign espionage and penetration and concentration and success, the Russians wrote the book on it. The United States did not when it came to human intelligence. So I'm rather cynical about the entire intelligence community in the United States and its capability historically to do the right thing, not only by normal human moral standards, but also the do the right thing to make America either a better place or the same place for freedom and liberty. But what you discover historically, when you go back not 100 years, but thousands of years of human history, is that large governments can only exist if they have very sophisticated and large intelligence operations and very large, wide, and deep informant classes and the incentives therein, East Germany, I'm looking at you, to make sure that the entire country itself, from a national security and intelligence apparatus perspective, is pretty much going to follow the political winds dictated from the central government, or through perverse incentives, they find ways to ensure that liberty and freedom aren't as vital or as free as they used to be. I think that categorically, large intelligence communities in all of their tentacled entities throughout a given domestic community, like the United States, like the West, like the Allies, and their espionage overseas inevitably cause chaos avalanches, cause significant problems for national security to start to decay, or in this case, what we've seen is that empire after empire uses these entities domestically and internally to ensure that the masses do what the central government wants done. Let's get to fundamentals. What is intelligence, that word? And I'm not talking about human intelligence or IQ or anything like that. What I'm talking about is the practice of intelligence, the craft of intelligence. What is it? Picture this, and I'm going to make it as simple as possible. The global information market, as it were, is this mass of billions and billions of transactions and knowledge factors and people's observations and people's observations of people that are close to them or not so close to them and the conclusions that they come to and all of the premises that form what's going to become conclusions about how the world works, how it operates, whether it should or would. And it's the entire ocean that we all swim in through which our intellectual cogitation is able to sort out, and we do our everyday things of taking care of ourselves, improving ourselves, educating ourselves, or preparing for the future. Out of that, the intelligence functionality is one in which, like the intelligence community in the United States, whether it's the CIA, the National Security Agency, the FBI, and any number of others under which the Director of National Intelligence, which was formed after 9/11 to sort of coalesce and ride herd on all the different intelligence communities, both military and civilian, in the United States and in the West, in order to, get this, make them more effective. Well, we all know that hasn't worked out too well. But in the end, what they're trying to do is have actionable intelligence. And actionable intelligence is rather easy to grok. Actionable intelligence means that we know the who, what, where, when, and why of something, and that whether it is assassination, manipulation, shaping, black propaganda, white propaganda, or whatever is focused on that particular entity or group of entities, actionable intelligence is all the data one has gathered that you need to start or continue operations to shape and influence conditions somewhere else into something that you want them to be as far as outcome. One can see where this can be abused. One can see where human foibles would cause this to be a big problem or maybe a success. I would point to an intelligence success would be the reading of the classified and encrypted Japanese and German mail, as it were, I put that in quotes, through Enigma and what the English did in cryptography, what the Americans did in cryptography, breaking the Japanese purple diplomatic codes and things like that. I think there's where one can look at an intelligence win in, wow, isn't this different, where they were actually collecting intelligence on the enemy instead of their own people to make determinations to shape the conditions of success from a military perspective. So I'm not painting all intelligence operations as bad. I'm just painting most of them as bad. Not only are they bad in the moral outcomes, the efficacious outcomes, the shaping of conditions that, in fact, makes things worse, as is going to be the fundamental notion of this entire short podcast series on Storming America, where we actually have this kind of, I would characterize it in a fashion as a jihadist invasion of America in an asymmetric fashion. This is going to occur in spite of the fact that America spends $100 billion plus on intelligence activities. That would be $76 billion appropriated for 2023, for instance, in the intelligence community for the civilian aspects, and about $27 billion for the military aspects of intelligence gathering and intelligence work and things like that. Now, mind you, I have a number here of $100 billion, and of course, this is part of the $1 trillion military-industrial intelligence complex that includes nuclear weapons programs, which is why one would take the DOD and the DOE programs, and you can shorten it up to $1 trillion to say that's what we are spending on the national security state in the U.S. and the West, but in the U.S. in particular. Because what happened here is that the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence after 9/11, because of all the manifest intelligence failures with 9/11, where no one was able to predict, even though ex post facto and in hindsight, all the factors were there for one to be able to forecast, nay, predict that these things would happen, but agencies weren't talking to each other, which is what the Director of National Intelligence was created for. And in 2007, they wanted a little bit more transparency on how much these agencies were spending under the DNI, hence this $100 billion figure that I have for you. But I'm telling you that this $100 billion figure is probably not complete. There's probably a lot of cutouts and black funds that are distributed to other agencies throughout the federal government that the intelligence community uses to do whatever dark and arcane arts they are participating in. Now, we certainly don't have time in the brevity of this podcast or podcast series to go do a deep dive on critical thinking, evidentiary thinking, how one apprehends the world, and why intelligence failures happen the way they do, just all a distillation of what basically comes down to the elements of evidence, a distillation of, well, is that correlative or causative? Is this intelligence failure, is it due to ignorance? Is it due to self-interest? What is the reason for it? Now, a quick departure, and that would be this. I used to teach critical thinking. We home-educated our children, and we had a home education cooperative in which not only did I teach critical thinking, but I was also a coach and a mentor for the forensics and debate teams and things like that. And, of course, when you're doing forensics and debate competitions, one has to have a very good grasp and sensibility of what good argument looks like. Now, good argument is based, of course, on evidence. It's based on having a prismatic approach to looking at things. You're looking at it from the opposite side you may be contending with or the converse of that very thing. But I also like to pin it down to something that's rather simple. This is from the University of the Intuitively Obvious, which is that critical thinking is thinking about thinking to improve your thinking through better thinking. And the reason why most people on planet Earth don't want to do that is because critical thinking is hard work. It's tedious. It can be boring. It can lead to maybe unpleasant conclusions that one doesn't want to entertain. As a matter of fact, I'm sort of jumping ahead here, but I'm going to say it anyhow. I so wish that the intelligence community that I was involved with in the past had taken the time to instantiate the 10th man, to instantiate red teaming, to instantiate contrarian attitudes and viewpoints, maybe even have an office that's required in all of these bureaucracies in which you've got to have a guy sitting in an office who has a sour attitude, who is always contrarian, who is a perennial mismatcher, to examine whatever conclusions you have come to, especially for those in the operations directorates in these various intelligence organizations, to war game and red team just what it is you intend to do, or maybe in the process, just what it is you think you're doing, or maybe ex post facto in the forensics examination of the various and manifest legions of failures of the intelligence community in the West on why did that happen. But that kind of thing isn't going to happen because bureaucrats and bureaucracies aren't built to tolerate that kind of internal disagreement. As you all know, presidential archives have been in the news now for years as a result of political contestants in the political sphere in the United States trying to pin the tail on the donkey, as it were, on various malfeasance and maybe even malcontents who are participating in a fashion that the other party doesn't like very much. The National Archives has three exceptions for declassification. Those exceptions are NSA signals intelligence from before 1942. That's a head-scratcher for me. How the Secret Service guards the president, and how much gold is in Fort Knox. Now, these are the things that they say outwardly to all of us who may not have the insights nor the classification access to the thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of compartmentalized security and classified programs that are present in the intelligence community in America and the West. Now, I'm not going to bore you with classification to a large extent, but I'll give you a brief snapshot. Now, the first instances of classification of intelligence occurred in 1869 in America. This current system that we suffer under was developed in the 1930s. One estimate in 2010 was that 90% of whatever is classified now shouldn't be classified, and I can personally attest to that. Classification entities and such, it appears they generate 50 million classified modalities a year. I'm saying modalities, and the reason I'm saying that is because if I said 50 million classified documents a year, there are derivative classification sets in classification, and what it means is that one can take an original document, and if you write something, let's say a white paper that refers to that document, hence we've seen in the past, and you've probably seen this on the news, where, well, there was part of that document, what, maybe one sentence out of 10 paragraphs that had an S secret, a TS top secret, a C confidential for that one sentence, which makes that entire document classified, hence deriving from it and hence classifying the entire document because of one sentence in all of those. Now, what's fascinating about this is that I think it was December 2022, 16,000 JFK files for review. 70% of them were cleared, apparently. Remember, this happened in 1962, 63, 64. I think they've been released. I know that there's a lot of JFK assassination aficionados out there who are probably poring over that in a very detailed and critical fashion in determining what conclusions, new ones, can be derived at as a result of that. So that'll be fascinating once that comes. One thing that I need to get through everybody's understanding is this. Just because something is classified doesn't make it better information than unclassified information. Hence the popularity in the last 30 years of what's called OSINT in the intelligence community, which is open source intelligence, which is going through stuff that has no classification whatsoever. It could be news weeklies, it could be news agencies, it could be white papers, it could be academic papers. It's open source intelligence. And then you take varieties of this and collate it together or put it together and try to come to conclusions. Tom Clancy got in trouble in the 80s and 90s where folks said, man, scratching their heads, he's really got a good bead on what the military is about in the U.S. and where does he get all this information? He got it through this notion of comprehension. I'm putting that word comprehension in quote marks here. And what it is it's that just through happenstance and the interdisciplinary ferment that happens when one connects various things from different disciplines and such, that he comes to conclusions that were divined at the classified level, but through open source intelligence and information in this case, one can connect the dots and come to those conclusions without any access whatsoever to the classified documentation. There is always this continuing conceit, and of course, this is lionized in the media, in the schools, in the university systems. And of course, the IC sees no problem with this as what I would characterize white propaganda that, well, we've got access, we've got to protect our sources, we've got these sources that say the following things. I guarantee you, ex post facto, in hindsight, if you were to take a look at a lot of these, a lot of this would have been available through unclassified means to come to the same conclusions. There's yet another reason why the government is so keen on classification, because it is a means for them to hide their malfeasance, hide their incompetence, hide their bad intent, and hide the trail of tears that is almost the entire story of American intelligence collection and actions throughout the past 100 years. For instance, and this will be an unpopular opinion, what we see again and again pounded into our little noggins from the mainstream corporate and access media is that white supremacy is the number one threat in America, and that it isn't fill in the blank of whatever other malcontent or hyphenated human being would be responsible for the lion's share of violence or a part of the violence, because some of that simply can't be said out loud in polite company. What I always ask for is I say, what is the empirical data to show that that is the threat that they make it out to be? Now, for a variety of reasons that we don't have to entertain in this podcast, I'll leave that to you and your own research and your own conversations with friends, family, and colleagues. You can see that to a certain extent, one can divine that that is misdirection, that is legerdemain, that is trying to make you look in a certain direction, because if you looked in another direction, you may come to conclusions that are not salient nor beneficial for the acting government in charge in the United States or the West. What one discovered, for instance, in 1993 with the bombing in New York, and in 2001 with 9/11, was to a certain extent the intelligence community had to cast a blind eye on ethnic, racial, or ideological origins. Otherwise, they would get in trouble for profiling. And of course, one thinks profiling is a bad word. I remember when I was in a regular warfare instructor and also teaching critical thinking and how irregular warfare works, the fundamentals, the nuts and bolts. When my students would first come to class, I would pose the question. By the way, I love Socratic drilling because I thought it was a great way to teach students, especially when you're talking about the intelligence community, to teach people who are critical thinkers. Again, critical thinking is thinking about thinking to improve your thinking through better thinking. And I would canvass the room and I would say, please raise your hand if you have a negative connotation to the word that I say next. So I had everybody's attention, and the word I would say is discrimination. Practically everybody, remember this is the after 2001, practically everybody would raise their hands, and I'd always be fascinated by one or two or three who wouldn't raise their hand, and I'd talk to them after class. So I'd say thank you for that, and I would explain the reason why you think discrimination is a bad word is because that's been drilled into you by the corporate access media. That word, almost like a dog whistle, is one that, oh, we can't discriminate. Of course, going back to profiling, one cannot assign any kind of pretension or assumption of how someone behaves simply by their pigmentation or ethnic origin or anything like that. All well and good in its own narrow sense. But I also explain that here you are, you're in an intelligence community, you're in a special operations community, and discrimination is part of pattern building. Discrimination is part of making sense of all of these bins we have intellectually to make sense of the world, what the DOD even calls sense-making. One word, sense-making. I urge you all to get the book if you get a chance. I'll make sure that I put that in the show notes. And if you can't bin things, if you can't identify them, if you can't label them, if you can't attach a referent to what it actually means, if you can't have a consensus on the definitional construct of what you're trying to make sense of in the world, you will not make sense of the world. So by having this kind of almost knee-jerk reaction to a word that is such a fundamental component of good thinking, that's also very concerning. Richard J. Hoyer, H-E-U-E-R, wrote a book called Psychology of Intelligence Analysis. I think it was published in 1999. You can find the PDF online. I think it's less than 200 pages. Highly recommend that you get it. This guy spent nearly 45 years in the CIA as both a government employee and a contractor later on, and really concerned about critical thinking and bias and how one discerns information from intelligence, from actionable intelligence, how one arrives at conclusions, things like that. So I will also put that in the show notes. I know that some of my listeners are cringing because I'm always making book recommendations, to which I'll make another one, which is one that I've talked about in the past, which is How to Read a Book by Mortimer Adler. If you read How to Read a Book and The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis by Richard J. Huer, and you really take those things to heart and you really try to make those part of your daily, weekly, monthly practice of making a cognitive living, I guarantee you good results if you pay attention. So here we are at intelligence failure, which is wide, deep, manifest, and legion in the United States and the West for a variety of reasons. Now, one of those reasons that I talked about before was ignorance. Was it complete ignorance, a lack of cultural IQ of what one was extrapolating or examining outside of the United States? And we're, by the way, we're going to confine ourselves in this examination of intelligence failure to external and not domestic intelligence failure concerns. Even though one can look at the FBI, for instance, and you find that a lot of the entrapment and violent encounters that they've been involved in, these so-called, I'm using air quotes, thanks Mike Myers, for these domestic terror incidents and such, the lion's share of those domestic terror incidents are created by organizations within the domestic United States. I would urge all of you to take a look at the transcripts or even the amusing video footage from the Gretchen Whitmer kidnapping trial in Michigan and what came out in that as far as how the FBI, as the Keystone Cops that they are, it appears, conducted themselves when it came to that particular entrapment scheme and just the Three Stooges-style chaos avalanches that ensued as a result of them trying to create a domestic terrorism event out of whole cloth. So we're going to talk about bias for a little bit, and what I wanted to talk about was the fact that, of course, every human being is biased and equipped with bias filters. It's one reason why, over the years, when people have asked me, well, Bill, where do you get your news? Well, I certainly don't watch news broadcasts. There's a reason why they call it programming. I always urge people to read editorials and opinion content. Even go to places with content you may not agree with in order to achieve that kind of prismatic examination of what is the other side thinking, what kind of evidence are they garnering, and what are they doing to come to the conclusions to form the premises that they're employing to come to the conclusions that they do. Employ Socratic drilling. Socratic drilling is maybe Ono's five whys, or just continuing to ask the question of why. For instance, no matter how fundamental it could be anything from dog training to rifle marksmanship to intelligence analysis and everything in between. Keep asking yourself or those that you're questioning, well, why, when they answer questions, substantive questions that you have, until you have exhausted them and they've reached what I love to call intellectual bankruptcy and they can't give you any more information because they don't know why. And fundamentally of who, what, where, why, and when, fundamentally the why is probably the most important aspect of all information and intelligence gathering when it comes to future shaping and influence operations that one intends to use. Now, from the CIA perspective, for instance, that would be an intelligence analysis coming to conclusions that will forecast or predict the future behavior of other nations who may either endanger the United States and its allies, or in its particulars in a region, what conflict is going to emerge there? What will these conflict bands do? How will the individual actors behave at the subnational, national, and regional level? And one can get answers to those questions by trying to do that Socratic drilling. And also, it makes you more informed about the shaping and the influence operations that you want to participate in. Everybody is biased. It's built in. That's what we do for a living. We're biased. Now, we're biased in a number of ways. The two that we want to treat here is we're biased by our language because, of course, the way we speak forms the patterns intellectually that we use to apprehend, appreciate, and understand the world around us. It would be that distinction in the military between SA and SU, which is situational awareness, is situational understanding. Situational awareness is I go into a restaurant and I look around and, oh, look, people dress like me, people talking like me, people sitting at tables, people seem to be happy, people seem to be content. Those of us who have certain backgrounds can go in there and achieve a situational understanding from that situational awareness of, well, that guy there seems a little agitated. Oh, I noticed that he appears to be carrying a weapon. Or you look elsewhere and you find that things are going on outside that you didn't understand before. That is what situational understanding is. Situational understanding is taking those awareness stipulations that you had prior under situational awareness and forming them into an understanding paradigm so that it can speak to action that you may have to take, in this case, to protect yourself in the present or the near future. Of those 200-some pages in Richard J. Scheuer's book, The Psychology of Intelligence Analysis, and I think for the most part, 90% of the conclusions he came to are still cogent and applicable to today and, well, mind you, probably the future. Chapter 12, Biases in Estimating Probabilities. I wanted to quote from this. It says, in making rough probability judgments, people commonly depend upon one of several simplified rules of thumb that greatly ease the burdens of decision. Using the availability rule, people judge the probability of an event by the ease with which they can imagine relevant instances of similar events or the number of such events that they can easily remember. Mind you, easily remember, keep that in mind. With the anchoring strategy, people pick some natural starting point for a first approximation and then adjust this figure based on the results of additional information or analysis. Typically, they do not adjust the initial judgment enough. Expression of probability such as possible and probable are a common source of ambiguity that make it easier for a reader to interpret a report as consistent with the reader's own preconceptions. The probability of a scenario is often miscalculated. Data on prior probabilities, he has that in quotation marks, are commonly ignored unless they illuminate causal relationships. There is a lot to draw from that. And one thing I want to make note of here is that the book that I recommended, not only in this episode, but episodes past, and I hope that you've taken advantage of it, and you don't have to read it cover to cover. You can find places in there that you want to read, is the syntopical reading conceit by Mortimer Adler and How to Read a Book. He has four levels of reading there. The first level of reading is the most rudimentary, which is that level at which one reads cover to cover. You're doing it in a casual fashion. You're not necessarily interrogating. Maybe you're reading a work of fiction, and you discover that as a result of that, that was fun. I learned a few things. The fourth level of reading is what he calls syntopical reading. And this is really fascinating, and I know that a lot of my listeners, if you're listening to this podcast, you're an odd bird to begin with. But I know a lot of my listeners have probably unconsciously participated in this. So, you know, I really dig the idea of unconscious competence, because on that competence spectrum from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence to conscious competence to unconscious competence, and we always want to go in that direction with everything that we do. When it comes to the business of reading and cogitation and intellectual examination and arguing with others or arguing with ourselves, Mortimer Adler came up with this really simple, I wouldn't call it an axiom, but it sort of works that way, which is that if you read 3 to 5 books on the same subject or more, you don't have to simply read 3 to 5, you can read 10 to 12 if you wish, or hundreds of them on the same subject, no matter how arcane it may be, through active interrogation in your reading, you're going to achieve a level of understanding that exceeds that of most academics who have been buried in that for the longest time. And of course, when we're speaking to academics, we're also speaking to the analytical hubs and the analyst individuals and the management of analysts in the intelligence community, where maybe you'll find yourself at a Middle Eastern desk, or you're at a Syrian desk, or you're in an African desk, or whatever the case may be where you're originally focused, or you happen to be at a ballistic missile desk or a MANPADS desk, which all you do is examine from an intelligence perspective all the variations and tactics, techniques, and procedures of employing passive acquisition, ground, surface-to-air missiles that one can shoulder. Maybe it's an RPG-29. Maybe it's a Stinger. Maybe it could be infantry weapons such as the AT-4 or recoilless rifles. Whatever the case may be, you're reading report after report, and you're assuming and garnering a level of expertise in that that not only influences what you've read and what you can instantiate in an empirical fashion, but you're also building intuition engines. You're also building a sensibility that everybody in my audience, no matter what you may do, you're a roofer, you're a driver, you're in the military, you're an engineer, you're an academic, whatever the case may be, when you are steeped in what you do for a living and you pay attention to it, over time, especially as a gray beard, you develop these sensibilities where you don't have to refer to conscious stuff, but you can employ unconsciously your intuition engine that tells you what's right and what's not right. Now, one would say, with everything I said in the previous preamble, that this kind of unconscious competence, intuition engines, and situational understanding in the broader context from an intelligence perspective of trying to understand and grok precisely not only how an entity or number of entities behave, but in conversations tangentially and adjacent to you with other people who have other specialties that may touch on what you do, you can come up with some really good intelligence estimates. And estimates are, what's their disposition and composition? In other words, disposition is, where is everything? Composition is, what do they have that they put to where is everything? And who are these leaders in their military, for instance? Who are these leaders in their political infrastructure? What kind of forecasting or predictive behaviors can we get from having this kind of cross-examination, this kind of fermentation between what appear to be stovepiped or cylinders of excellence of inquiry in the intelligence organizations and intelligence agencies? I suspect, as much as I can show you, as I have demonstrated in the last few minutes, the ideal way to ascertain not only that situational awareness, but to achieve what I would grok as the most important thing, which is situational understanding, that not only gives you a present baseline, not only gives you an historical baseline, but from both of those things allows you to extrapolate into the future, depending on the evidence that you have, a forecasting or prediction paradigm that allows you to see, well, what's going to happen? What is the future conflict or future behavioral constructs that we're going to see? And if we seek to either influence those or stop those, how are we going to do it? And one would think, and Dr. Heuer, Richard J. Heuer, the author of Psychology of Intelligence Analysis, the guy seems to have done a lot of homework. From my perspective as a layman, looking at what I've seen produced out of this $100 billion intelligence combine in the U.S. and the West, they're not very good at any of this. Let me give you a for instance. So I think I mentioned in the past that I won the lottery. I had this opportunity to be a student intern at the Hoover Institution in the 1980s. And on occasion, I had the opportunity to work with one Robert Conquest, who has always been one of those Kremlinologists. He was around forever. I have probably a complete stack of his books that he published, to include his extraordinary work on the terror famine by the Soviets in the Ukraine, and a number of other books on the Soviet Union. Mind you, this is before 1989. This is before the fall of the wall. This is before the fall of the USSR. Robert Conquest was a contrarian. he was an outlier. He was not received well by fellow criminologists, and he was pretty much a voice in the wilderness, much as Churchill was about the National Socialist threat in the 1930s, where he was confined to the outer reaches of the parliament because of what was perceived as his out-of-step apprehension of how the world worked at the time. Conquest knew that the Russian Empire was evil. He knew the Soviets were evil, and he knew the system didn't work. Now, mind you, this is in the 1980s, and this is when Paul Samuels had an economics text, the best-selling economics text in the world at the time, and continued to be, which, during the 1980s, published, and I'm paraphrasing, sections of said text, which said that the Soviet model of economic manipulation, expansion, and provision of goods and services is the superior model to capitalism in that it will overtake it over time. Paraphrasing again. Samuelson, to me, was just an awful economist. I happen to be an Austrian economist, and of course, we are out of step. We are outliers, and we aren't accepted by the mainstream economics community. But nonetheless, I wear that hat proudly. Conquest was the only one to call the ball. He was the only one to say, in the mid-1980s, this cannot stand, it will not last, and it will collapse. And he was laughed at by all the Kremlinologists at the time. Because all the Kremlinologists at the time, the Sovietologists, the specialists, to include those who worked in foggy bottoms at the State Department, to include those who were making the intelligence estimates under George Bush Sr., for instance, when he took over the CIA, all of these intelligence agencies were coming up with the notion that this was a very big, bad bear harnessed to an economic system that would soon overwhelm the West. We'd been hearing that since the 1930s, haven't we? There was almost an academic capture by the Soviet ideal and by the pretensions of communist politics and politicians and economic conclusions and such that informed the way they examined and analyzed the Soviet threat, the possible Soviet successes and such, which means that between 1989 and 1991, when all of the intelligence organizations, and especially the Central Intelligence agencies, were just caught flat-footed, flat on their backs, not making the proper assessment, and not being able to predict what would happen in 1989, 90, and 91, with the spinoff and eventual glacial calving of all the Stan brothers on the underbelly of the Soviet Union, they were all caught flat-footed. They were all surprised. I mean, and like I mentioned earlier, I'm certain that there was an Uzbekistan desk. I'm certain that there were fill-in-the-blank Stan desks throughout the CIA, probably staffed with one officer, if not several intelligence analyst officers who would, I hope, have meetings of, here we are, the component parts and pieces of the USSR. Here are the conclusions that we're coming to when we look at the economic indices, the manufacturing indices, the military indices, the effectiveness indices, and the political indices of what's going on. And they were all caught flat-footed. Now, we go to the 1993 bombing. Oh, that caught us by surprise in New York. 2001, you have 911. Ah, that's a surprise. Then, of course, we have the military going into Iraq, going into Afghanistan, going into Libya, going into the Horn of Africa, going into Syria, and every place in between, and all of the intrigues and palace coups of whatever variety one can come up with in that time after the fall of the Soviet Union. But as I had alluded to previously in a cryptic fashion of dropping all of these former Eastern European emigres to the West by parachute into landing zones that were probably directed by the KGB at the time and into the loving arms of the Soviet state, again and again and again, the Directorate of Operations at the CIA, fundamentally the folks who were conducting the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, as Churchill would say it, with espionage operations, stay-behind operations, collaboration operations, turning operations, knock operations, non-official cover, and all of those kind of things, rather unsuccessfully. The point that I'm getting at here is that intelligence failure isn't a unique component of the U.S. intelligence community, even though I think they excel at it. It is a component of the way humans apprehend the world, the way politicians, bureaucracies, and intelligence, when they're connected to each other, behave in a fashion that is not only injurious to truth, but behave in a fashion that almost gives an incentive to create chaos avalanches where the law of unintended consequences and the extrapolation of second and third order effects simply isn't taken into account with the due diligence that it should. And as I'm fond of pointing out, Newton's third law is a stone-cold motherfucker when it comes to everything that it touches. And in this case, it touches things in a fashion that is so injurious to a proper apprehension of the world that you find yourself, after a lot of these intelligence operations and intelligence failures take place, in a worse position than you were before any of that happened. And in this case, you spent $100 billion for the privilege. So these intelligence failures, and of course, I would urge my listeners to look that up and left, right, collectivist, individualist, whatever your perspective happens to be with that phraseology of intelligence failure. Well, it failed because they didn't get enough money. Well, it failed because they weren't paying attention to that corner of the world. Well, it failed because they didn't do the proper cross-examination and interdisciplinary and cross-fermentation between different people looking at different things where they'd all get in a room and they'd take a decision and say, yeah, I love this phraseology, and it's one that I employed when I worked in this. How are we going to divine the single most accurate picture? Because you can't get the 100% picture. You'll never have that because we're human beings. What is the single most accurate picture that, I hate to say this, that is almost a consensus of all the analysts in the room? But then again, that is part of this problem bureaucratically, is that when you get a consensus in a room that isn't red-teamed, that doesn't have a 10th man, that doesn't have a paid contrarian who is protected for his contrarianism, you are going to get involved in groupthink that is going to cause significant damage to making your way to that single most accurate picture. And if you don't harness that to moral courage, in which you're willing to tell the people who want these analytical products that they may be wrong, and this is what may be wrong in their thinking, and these are the things that they have to do other than what their intent was in the first place, the lack of that moral courage has led to so much loss of blood and treasure and maiming and killing of men, women, and children planet-wide for centuries, if not millennia. But when we compress it and we look at this particular episode since the 1870s of U.S. foreign policy and what it has done to conduct conflict planet-wide, intelligence has never been a strong suit for how America fumbles around on the planet in a martial sense. And in my mind, this all comes down quite simply, and I don't want to simplify something that is rather complex, and this is, but I do want to make this single observation. If you don't harness bias filters, understand bias filters, and wrap your head around the fact that whatever you've read, whatever's informed you, you may be dead wrong. And if you're in a pecking order, we all live in baboon troops, don't we, as human beings? If you're in a pecking order where that kind of alternate thinking isn't accepted, then you are probably going to foment wrong conclusions that will lead to very bad outcomes. For instance, we love to talk about, well, the U.S. military is the best in the world. It's this. I happen to think that the United States military is probably the most expensive paper tiger in the history of mankind. But nonetheless, and we will cover that in future episodes, but nonetheless, you would think that, and I've mentioned this in probably episodes going all the way back to episode 2, even though the British military wins all of their victories in spite of their best efforts, the British, as a society, have a penchant to accept or even, maybe not even look down upon, but embrace eccentricity, unorthodox thinking. Hence, you have T.E. Lawrence of Arabia. Hence, adjacent to that, you have Michael Collins, with the Irish bringing down parts of the British Empire in 1916 to 1922. You have Ord Wingate. You have the gentleman who gave us the Special Air Service in World War II. You have the unorthodox thinking, and one can even classify Churchill in this, as much as I loathe a lot of what he did, but there are things to admire. He was always one to say, you know, when it came to Special Operations Executive, for instance, which was the British counterpart to the Office of Strategic Services, which was his Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, he would have people in there and support and endorse people who were in there who were outliers, who were folks who were eccentric, unorthodox, and all of those things. And that led, in my mind, to better thinking and better outcomes. In the end, when I look back to the military decision-making process, which for the most part is a positive way to do things, MDMP, I urge my listeners to look it up if you're not familiar with it. Those of you who are, you can practice it in your everyday life, as I do with the OODA loop and things like that. But what you find is that you're asked, well, okay, what's the worst-case scenario and what's the most likely scenario? For folks involved in intelligence, those two questions are of primary importance for everything that they do. As a matter of fact, I would make that the intent statement of everything these analytical desks and desks of desks and those in charge of those desks do for a living, is that they take that determination. Well, what's most likely to happen, which is a forecast and predictive modeling epistemology. Okay, what's the worst thing that can possibly happen? And why, of course, would we want to look at the worst case? So that we can make sure that we're assessing that in a fashion where, well, if it's worst case, we've got the following preparations in mind. Because planning is a great idea. And if you can plan for contingencies, it's an even better idea, because at least you are preparing yourself and you're leaning forward in a fashion that will allow you to do the right thing when the time comes, because at least you've contemplated it. So I need to read this extraordinary passage from Heuer's book. He's talking about bias. He says, quote, "It appears, however, that the receipt of what is accepted as definitive or authoritative information," this is Bill stepping out of the quote, "remember that there is this absolutely ill-conceived and stupid elucidation in the intelligence community that classified information has a provenance and an efficiency all its own that makes it superior to all OSINT. That is sheer naked stupidity, but that informs so much of the intelligence community throughout the Western world." Going back to this. "But it causes an immediate but unconscious restructuring of a person's mental images to make them consistent with the new information. Once past perceptions have been restructured, it seems very difficult, if not impossible, to reconstruct accurately what one's thought processes were or would have been before this restructuring. There is one procedure that may help to overcome these biases. It is to pose such questions as the following. Analysts should ask themselves," and please burn this into your memories, listeners, "if the opposite outcome had occurred, would I have been surprised? If the opposite outcome had occurred, would I have been surprised? Consumers should ask, if this report has told me the opposite, would I have believed it? And overseers should ask," in this case, Heuer calls overseers those management entities within the intelligence community that would oversee a collection of desks or oversee a cabal of analysts. "An overseer should ask, if the opposite outcome had occurred, would it have been predictable given the information that was available? These questions may help one recall or reconstruct the uncertainty that existed prior to learning the content of a report or the outcome of a situation." End of quote. I want to step in once again. Uncertainty. What does that mean? Uncertainty is the provenance. It is the sine qua non. It is the raison d'etre for everything that happens in intelligence, because what intelligence is trying to do is take things that have the quality of uncertainty and understand them better so that they can move themselves to the right, whether left of bang or right of bang, to establish that uncertainty can be understood. Nassim Taleb talks about this in The Black Swan when he talks about events that all of a sudden seem to come out of nowhere. But ex post facto and in hindsight, we can look at those events and say, Of course, we should have known if we had been paying attention to the non-linear factors that instead seem to have a linearity all of their own once you take a look at them. And he goes on. This method of overcoming the bias can be tested by readers of this chapter. That's chapter 12. Especially those who believe it failed to tell them much they had not already known. If this chapter had reported that psychological experiments showed no consistent pattern of analysts overestimating the accuracy of their estimates or of consumers underestimating the value of our product, would you have believed it? Answer, probably not. If it had been reported that psychological experiments show these biases to be caused only by self-interest and lack of objectivity, would you have believed this? Answer, probably yes. And would you have believed it if this chapter had reported these biases can be overcome by a conscientious effort at objective evaluation? Probably yes. I happen to think that objective evaluation is very difficult to come by. Going back, quote, these questions may lead you, the reader, to recall the state of your knowledge or beliefs before reading this chapter. If so, the questions will highlight what you learned here, namely, that significant biases in the evaluation of intelligence estimates are attributable to the nature of human mental processes, not just to self-interest and lack of objectivity, and that they are, therefore, exceedingly difficult to overcome. End of quote. I would urge you to consider that not only are they difficult to overcome, but there may be a certain improbability to overcoming these with the digital screen degradation of human cogitation and intellectual tool chests available to discern good information from bad. As a matter of fact, you will note that misinformation and disinformation is a very popular notion nowadays, but when you examine those, what it happens to be is what is the consumer or digestion of that information leading to as far as outcomes. The leading purveyor of disinformation and misinformation is disproportionately governments throughout the centuries. Now, mind you, I'm looking here at Heuer's book, Conclusions, chapter 14. He talks about improving intelligence analysis. He provides checklists. I have no idea what's going on inside the IC and the CIA and the DIA and all of these other intelligence entities, and whether they have taken seriously these concerns and methodologies that Heuer talked about. And Heuer, by the way, didn't discover these. He didn't invent these. These have been around for centuries. This is what critical thinking is all about. This is the way to formalize that critical thinking so that one can take all the information that is available to you and come up with postulates and premises that lead to conclusions, whether correlative or causative, that improve your life as a human being or improve the life as a nation as far as guiding that nation to take actions that are beneficial. Now, what's fascinating about this is that I can't measure what's being done in those communities. What I can measure is what are the outcomes that I'm seeing planet-wide for the past century, if not longer, and the outcomes are uniformly terrible. Of course, in this podcast, I have driven home the fact that America hasn't won a single conflict since 1945, and driven home what appears to be the awful unintended consequences of American foreign policy and military policy around the planet since that time. Can I extrapolate from that? Look at this, we're doing intelligence analysis. That's because they haven't done this informed analysis that I've spent the past hour talking about, this kind of intellectual heavy lifting and critical thinking. I mean, it's all laid out here. For instance, he has a checklist for analysts with six key steps in the analytical process. He calls it defining the problem, generating hypotheses, collecting information, evaluating hypotheses, selecting the most likely hypotheses, in the ongoing monitoring of new information. By the way, isn't that eerily reminiscent of the scientific method? Of course it is, because they're related to each other, because what they're both trying to do is not forecast or predict an income in a leisurely fashion, but trying to be empirical, trying to do the quants and the qualitative assessments that allow one to look at all the available information that you have and come to those conclusions, whether effective or ineffective, of what that single most accurate picture is. If you don't mind, listeners, take those four words and burn them into your brain. You'll be able to use them every day. You know, Huer talks about training, and he says, quote, most training of intelligence analysts, by the way, this is 1999, most training of intelligence analysts is focused on organizational procedures, writing style, and methodological techniques. That first one, by the way, organizational procedures, would be informed by the bureaucracies, the government bureaucracies that they inhabit, which tend to be bureaucracies after the first 10 years of their formation that are much more concerned with the maintenance and expansion of their power and reach than effective methodological analyses of being able to tackle problem sets through sense-making and rigorous analysis to arrive at conclusions that match that of the real world. Not a lot of that has to take place, because that is a perverse incentive in bureaucracy if it goes against the ability of that bureaucracy to remain in power. He goes on, analysts who write clearly are soon to be thinking clearly. That's not the case. Yet it is quite possible to follow a faulty analytical process and write a clear and persuasive argument in support of an erroneous judgment. Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, one could say that that informs so much of American foreign policy in the last quarter century. And surprise, surprise, he has a paragraph called Exposure to Alternative Mindsets. Quote, the realities of bureaucratic life produce strong pressure for conformity. Management needs to make conscious efforts to ensure the well-reasoned competing views have the opportunity to surface within the intelligence community. Analysts need to enjoy a sense of security so that partially developed new ideas may be expressed and bounced off others as sounding boards with minimal fear of criticism for deviating from established orthodoxy. Much of this book has dealt with ways of helping analysts remain more open to alternative views. Management can help by promoting the kinds of activities that confront analysts with alternate perspectives. Consultation with outside experts, analytical debates, competitive analysis, devil's advocates, gaming, and interdisciplinary brainstorming. Now, by the way, that last one, interdisciplinary brainstorming, it's the chemical engineer that ran into the electrical engineer, and they both came up with a car battery. That kind of interdisciplinary ferment is probably the seed and fulcrum of most innovation in the Western world in the last several years. So I would hope that all of this, I've given you sort of an intelligence 101 and how we may do it better and what we're facing with a government bureaucratic intelligence organization, even funded at the lavish levels of $100 billion a year, fails to instantiate, or I would suggest, capture realistically what's going on. For instance, when we look at the special military operation, which inaugurated in February 2022, where the Russians invaded the Ukraine after redlining and warning us, is back in 1991, and even the present director of the CIA talked about 2008, where he said, this is a red line for this NATO expansion into the East, that the Russians will take action over time, flat-footed, caught flat-footed, the intelligence community. Wouldn't it be interesting to see from February 2021 to February 2022 to examine forensically all the U.S. and Western intelligence agencies and how many of them could have predicted what was in the offing as far as the special military operation by the Russians. I'm certain that they were caught flat-footed. For instance, before the departure from Afghanistan, you had analysts saying, oh, the ANA will do this and they'll last this long and such. I even said, yeah, I think I think the ANA may last a month. They lasted a week. I was wrong, but I didn't think they had any loitering capability to fight off the Taliban and all the other resistance elements that had coalesced around them to remove the Western invader from Afghanistan for the third time in two centuries. Which brings us, after this podcast, which is longer than usual, apologies for that, to the very disturbing conclusion that I'm about to offer, and that is this. Because of the lack of efficacy and effectiveness and critical thinking skills in the entire intelligence community, because of its bureaucratic refusal to institutionalize red teaming, counterfactual analysis, 10th man thinking, and contrarian thinking into the intelligence estimates that are the final product that reach the political class, who take all the decisions on how America is going to proceed forward. And when you harness that to the willful neglect of profiling and being politically incorrect about calling out ethnicities or hyphenations or accredited victim groups who may have a disproportionate impact on the domestic security of the country, when the October 7th style Gaza attack upscaled, upgraded, upsized, and absolutely terrifying happens in America, and a lot of this, and I'm not calling this the root cause in all of this is the lack of tolerance of contrarian thinking. One of the proximate causes, as we entertain in engineering, is that when you have this open border in which you have all of these NOCs, these illegals, and all of these entities that can come across and seek an asylum and such, who are not connected in any fashion to a database or identified to maybe prior behaviors in other countries in which they participated in terroristic or military functions and modalities, not tracked, they're here. Remember, these are fire-and-forget functionalities. Unlike Chinese NOCs, illegals, and could be Israeli, could be Russian, could be mostly Western-centric, even though the Chinese aren't Western-centric. But by exception, these jihadists, if they come here, whatever flavor or stripe of Islamic fundamentalism it may be, they are imbued with a fire-and-forget capability where, given the weapons, given the logistics, given the auxiliary assistance, given the communications, once the green light is lit for them to contemporaneously and spontaneously attack Americans or American public places or American infrastructure, and as I talked about in episode 37, these aren't my ideas. These are William Fortune's ideas from Day of Wrath. These are Kurt Schlichter's ideas from the attack. And those two gentlemen aren't the first ones to posit that this kind of internal attack could occur. There's a number of other authors and probably advocacy tanks, I don't call them think tanks, advocacy tanks out there that have talked about this very thing. Nothing will stop it from happening in America. It's coming. It's inevitable. So get ready. Be prepared. I talked about in episode 37 what you can do. This will be part two of a continuing series for the next few weeks in which I will pursue this line of inquiry to describe to you, I won't say exactly, I won't say precisely, but I will say in broad strokes what this attack is going to look like and why its inevitability is a shame for America. But there we are. This is Bill, out.